Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
There are, something like 20,000 delegates from around the world who are gathering in Montreal as part of a United Nations Biodiversity Summit, which is essentially, you know, all the people from around the world who are very worried about the environment flying in from all parts of the world on thousands of planes and private jets and everything else, but they're all getting here to save nature. It seems slightly awkward, but, you know, we'll leave that part alone for now. But one of the things that was proposed at this conference already is something called the Diet and Overconsumption Motion, which there are delegates who want to essentially, I guess, dictate what you should or should not be having available to you as far as proteins, because we all know that cows fart and that makes methane and that leads to the death of the planet. I thought cows were here long before we had global warming, but regardless, they fart and that's the problem. So they put forward this motion. Now, it did not pass by the looks of it. Nonetheless, it says something, I think, about where we start to see fingerprints going in things like food, which is becoming more expensive and for some people difficult to get. I want to bring in Dr. Sylvain Charlebois. He is the director of the Agri-Foods Analytics Lab at Dalhousie University. He is known as the food professor. We love having him on the show. Doctor, thanks for doing this today.
Well, thank you, Scott. I sense your skepticism in your voice.
Really? I mean, I know that you may share the same because I saw your tweet about this, and the last line is, we should keep governments out of kitchens. I think we should be keeping governments out of a whole lot of places that they're starting to push into a little bit here, but I just don't see, other than the farting cow problem, what the issue is here.
Well, it's a matter of disciplining the public or encouraging people to eat less animal protein. Animal proteins are the target right now, and what's going on basically with I would call them eco extremists is that as soon as you eat a steak, it's everyone's problem, and that's where I think the narrative goes too far, because first of all, I think everyone should have the right to choose what they want to eat. First of all, if you mandate the government or governments to ask people to eat certain ways, you basically deny the fact that food is culture. Food is about traditions, family. We're a few days away from gathering with family and friends, and I suspect that most of us will have something that looks like meat on the table.
Yeah.
And because that's what we've done for many, many, many years. And so when I see some of these motions come forward, and those motions are essentially motivated by the Eat Lancet diet, which basically would get someone to eat a diet in which 10% of it is actually animal protein. Just to give you an idea, Scott, right now most Canadians will have probably at least 40% of their diets dedicated to animal proteins. And that would include dairy, meat, and fish and seafood. So it's really an idealistic sort of scenario. I there's nothing wrong encouraging people to eat different ways, but using the environment as an excuse to get governments to mandate diets, that is just really scary.
I agree that there's nothing wrong with them encouraging us to do that. And we've had, the Canada Food Guide for years telling us here's
absolutely
a healthy way to eat, but they don't say, but you must have, there's, you know, the four major food groups, you must have 25% of each or something. It's here's a guide to do it. But
Scott, just to go back to the 2019 with the food guide, the new food guide, even then you kind of saw something happening. Nobody really noticed. I didn't notice because I read the darn thing. And in the food guide, there is mention of the environment. Since when the food guide is about the environment? It's about nutrition and health.
Well, there's another part about this too. So as I'm reading this, the impression that I'm getting, whether it's fair or not, the impression I'm getting, and you've made it pretty clear that it is let's move away from animal proteins and more to plant-based things. So we got to grow more stuff. But at the same time, our governments are saying, yeah, but you can't use fertilizers. And so everything that you're going to grow is going to become vastly more expensive. This all seems like it's moving towards something where we're going to have fewer foods that's going to cost a lot more for us and is going to be possibly a little bit unpredictable if the weather doesn't cooperate.
Well, I mean, I must say, I think Ottawa is a bit consistent on that one because you don't necessarily need fertilizer if your intention is to grow, is to produce fewer grains. Because let's face it, when you produce animal proteins, with cattle or meat, you do need more grains. But if the pressure is off, then you don't need as many grains on the market. So I think that's the rationale here. But again, going back to mandating diets, Europe actually voted in favor of the motion. Canada voted against. And let me tell you, I don't think that Canada voted against because of the environment argument. I think it has to do with our quota system. We have $32 billion worth of quotas, and no politician in Ottawa would dare touch at supply management because we know what happens when politicians try to suggest anything related to the quota system. They lose their jobs. I think that's basically why they decided not to touch that one.
But wouldn't, and again, I may be wrong on this, but if this motion was to pass, would this not likely lead to higher food prices?
I would say yes, absolutely.
And that would be another reason Canada wouldn't vote on it. Well, I mean, how popular is it going to be when people already are struggling with food prices if they come back with saying, wait, we just voted for something that's going to make it even more expensive. Look at us. How good for us. That wouldn't fly.
I got nervous last week because I know that Mr. Guilbeault, the Minister of Environment, did say that he was expecting Canada to support the diet and overconsumption motion, which I was a bit surprised, and of course we now know that Canada did not. The EU did. The EU is really on a path of destruction. I actually think that the EU has declared war against agriculture. You're seeing what's going on in the Netherlands, in other parts of the continent with fertilizer targets, with everything that's going on there. My goodness. I just hope that in North America we won't necessarily see that same shift, and I think it boils down to respect and choice. So I think it's important for people to realize that really food is a central part of our lives, not just because of the environment, but because of our traditions and culture. And I must say that really, if we forget that, we're going to be in trouble, because if you allow governments to dictate what goes on in our private kitchens, goodness, what else is going to happen? We're going to tax a whole lot of things too.
Well, we've got a growing world. We've got over 8 billion people now. Canada's talking about bringing in 500,000 more people a year. Nothing against immigration. That's, you know, that's great, but you have to make sure you can't add all these extra people and then make the production of food more and more and more difficult and reduce what people can get their hands on. It seems to be the opposite of what would make sense.
Yeah, well, urban politics are taking over the Western world, and I would include Canada in that sample, and I think it's important for governments to take some time and understand agriculture overall. And I think in 2023, we're going to see Ottawa doing some overtures there. I think there is going to be some deliberate effort to understand farmers. They're going to go out on a road, and I think that's a good thing, to talk to farmers, because right now you're seeing a tone-deaf government not willing to understand anything.
Mm. I saw a number of people referring to a quote, we got to run, but from a few years ago when the previous Trudeau was prime minister, about keeping the government out of the bedrooms of the nation. Should they also be keeping the governments out of the kitchens of the nation?
Well, I brought it up in my
op-ed. Oh, you wrote it too. Okay.
Ago. I basically ended my op-ed like that. I mean, yes, I think we've made some progress as a society to actually keep governments out of bedrooms and basically focus on freedoms and rights of people, no matter what gender you are, no matter what sexual orientation you have. I think there's something similar here with kitchens.
Yeah. Or we all just become vegan and we like it. Whether we like it or not, we like it. Eat your kale and
let's
your...
Let's respect vegans. Vegans are great, but yeah, well, I don't know. Like, some of us don't want to be vegans.
Or just eating... Eventually, we'll all be eating bugs, right? That'll be where it comes to. We'll all be just eating insects and we'll be happy about it. Yummy.
Yummy.
Sylvain Charlevoix, always love having you on. Thanks for taking the time today.
Take care, Scott. Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
We are hearing about a major... You've probably heard this if you've been listening to the weather, but a major winter storm coming in Friday by about noon. It's going to be raining. See, here's the plan. Now, let me just say this with all respect. It's the plan. We don't know exactly. But the plan is that it'll rain Friday morning, then it'll become frigid, and as Friday progresses, things get really, really terrible. The man who will get to bring all this good news to you, which obviously will make him the most popular man in the entire chorus/global universe, Anthony Farnell, Chief Meteorologist. Anthony, how are you today?
I am a busy man, but it's a good busy, I guess, because all is still calm, and you got anticipation ahead of another impactful storm. So, yeah.
Everybody wants a white Christmas. I'm not sure they want it like this, though.
Yeah, wind blown, drifting, and wind chills in the minus teens to minus 20s. Not ideal, but really it's the lead up. The busiest travel days that will be heavily impacted by this storm, not just locally, but across many states in the U.S., many provinces. And you're seeing now what's happening in Vancouver and just shutting down that airport. So that is that's something that we have to be concerned about if you are flying or driving in the coming days.
Okay, so as I understand what it looks like right now, Saturday may be snowy, maybe get some snow on the ground, but it's Friday that is going to be, by the sounds of it, the wild day when we're going to have rain followed by a flash freeze and then everything becomes a rink. Is that right?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. So the rain occurs overnight Thursday into very early Friday morning, and then we see that temperature go from about 5 degrees to minus five in just a few short hours' time with strong winds and possibly some snow as it transitions. So that flash freeze is something that, if the roads are untreated, will become a huge story. And then it turns to more of a wind event late in the day, especially if you're right near some of the Great Lakes, Lake Erie, Lake Ontario in particular, where 100 to 120 kilometer per hour winds are possible.
I think it was you, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was you that earlier in the week had put out a tweet with a map showing where huge winds could be, and it was an orange band that was essentially around the west end of Lake Ontario, as in Hamilton. We're in the area where you were even talking about power outages over Christmas.
Yeah, that is a distinct possibility. In fact, at Global and amongst a couple of my colleagues, the other weather guys as well, we're just wondering if these winds actually come to fruition and then they linger all day Saturday. So crews are going to have trouble getting to them before Christmas Day. So we should plan for perhaps power outages that last a couple of days. And that isn't ideal around Christmas, but it's always nice to be prepared, have those candles and everything ready to go in case that does occur. But yeah, you're right. That's orange band, what we call actually a sting jet, which can come down on the backside of these developing storms. They can bring even stronger winds. So we'll see if it materializes. But right now it looks highly likely that we're going to have numerous outages.
Okay, polar vortex was a word I caught a couple of years ago. Sting jet is a new one. You guys sit around a table somewhere and have conferences and come up with these great names. I know it. But what exactly would a sting jet do? Why would it happen and what does it mean?
Well, it's just basically like a scorpion tail, the sting at the end of that. So it basically wraps around bombogenesis, so a bomb cyclone, which is a rapidly deepening
storm. Okay, got that one.
Yep. There's another one, right? There's a criteria for that. And these are not made-up terms. These are actually, it was 20 years ago when I did my meteorology classes, but they were used back then. They're just popularized because of social media and because of everybody's recent obsession about the weather. So yes, the bomb cyclone, if it occurs just right on the backside, you can end up with clearing air and rapidly sinking. So mid-level winds and air sinks right down to the surface, and that can create these unusual winds over a path of 50 to 100 kilometers and following along the backside of the storm.
Now, one of the things that I haven't heard, and maybe it's just because it's one of the more minor things, so we haven't really talked about it, is usually anytime you started to get weird winds blowing around Lake Ontario, you'd also be talking about lake effect snow. I haven't heard that we're going to get hammered with that. Is that not a thing?
Nope, definitely a thing. It's just our time and our weather maps are only so big. So that is actually something that we're very concerned about as we go Friday night through Saturday, Sunday, Christmas Day as well. It will be less so in Hamilton, but if you're in the Fort Erie, Niagara region, 30 or more centimeters, very wow. likely from this. Lake Ontario will have its band, and also up in Cottage Country, Georgian Bay, from Grand Bend up through Kincardine, and this snow is going to be blowing around, but definitely lake effect is a concern as we get later into the cold air Friday night and Saturday.
All right, before I let you go, Anthony, I know that the most popular thing a weatherman could say or a weatherwoman could say is we're going to have a white Christmas. It's going to be a nice fluffy thing. Everything's going to fall overnight. And this is kind of like not the most popular thing. Honestly, even though you have nothing to do with it, do you ever get people reaching out going, come on, do you get people mad at you for these things?
Yes. And in this polarizing culture, a lot of the blame comes when people don't get what they expected, or if they maybe heard weather talk from somewhere else and then blame you. So it is kind of it comes with the territory, I guess. But you know what? It is that time of year where everybody has this extra concern. And hey, a white Christmas is a white Christmas in my books. And I think we're all, at least here in Ontario, going to end up with that, even if it comes with
well, listen,
snow. And
if people think you have that much power, take it and go with it. I mean, why not?
Exactly, right? I should run for something. But
run for your life if it's as bad as it is, if people get mad at you. Yeah. Anthony Farnell, Global's chief meteorologist, thanks for taking the time today. Really appreciate it.
All right, thanks for having me on.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
I don't know if you caught this the other day, but it was a few days ago that Pierre Poilievre gave a speech, and he was talking about things that are broken in Canada. And then Prime Minister Justin Trudeau responded a couple of days later saying, hey, everything's not broken in Canada. And now we're into a debate about what's broken, what's not. Just an intro to this, because someone was taking up that fight in a newspaper article, was taking up and looking, what is broken? What isn't? One of the things that they pointed to saying not broken, in fact, might be really good in this country right now, is marriage. That our divorce rates, according to the last numbers that we have available to us from StatsCan, the numbers show that our divorce rate has dropped precipitously in the last number of years. That a few years ago, mid to late 80s, we were up over at around 100,000 divorces a year. Now we are about half of that. That sounds like a very, very good thing. I want to bring in Dr. Lisa Strohschein. She's a sociology professor at the University of Alberta. This is one of the things she studies, is modern marriage. She joins us now. Doctor, thank you for this.
Hey, thanks for having me.
This seems, on its face, like it's a pretty optimistic, pretty good thing about how good we are at being married in this country now, is it?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think if you look at the context, you might have a slightly different perception. So yes, absolutely it's true. Uh-oh, did I lose you?
No. Uh-oh, I'm hoping we don't have a bad perception and we're not all that bad at marriage, but carry on.
So it's not that we're bad at marriage. It's just that we're not actually getting married so much these days. And that's the context. So Statistics Canada actually stopped reporting on these on the divorce rate for a number of years. So they stopped in 2011, and then they had data then just to 2008. And they stopped doing so because it presented a misleading picture of what was happening with couple relationships. So just recently, about a month or so ago, they did a kind of like a back backup. There's like, okay, here's all the figures that we now have, because the provinces still report all of this information to Statistics Canada. They just hadn't been reporting it. And so, yeah, on the surface, you're going to look at those numbers and say, wow, this is a great thing. The divorce rate is on the decline. It must mean that our marriages are stronger today. But the reality is that people have other options. So if you look at the 1981 census, about 6% of all co-residential couples were in cohabiting relationships. Today, that estimate is 23%. So that means almost one in four people now are not marrying. They're choosing to cohabit instead. And so that's why we have a misleading picture. We're only looking at marriage. And the thing of it is then, right, as a sociologist, we tend to look at this as a selection effect. That is, who is entering into marriage now? And if you think about it, and I think this will resonate with most Canadians, if you're in a cohabiting relationship that you aren't all that certain about, you don't know whether it's going to last or not, you're probably not going to say, hey, let's formalize this relationship. Right. Let's get married. And so that means that marriages today are quite different than they were in the past when marriage was more universal and there weren't other options such as cohabitation.
Okay, a lot of things you brought there. I want to go through a bunch of these. Let me go back for a second to where I started with this, with the numbers from StatsCan. There's a graph that they provide with this as well. And back in 1986, when the Divorce Act reform came in, which, as I understand it, if I recall, made divorce a whole lot easier, didn't have to go through as much. There is a gigantic spike in the number of divorces right around that time in Canada. Everything became easy. It has been a pretty consistent dip since then. Is that entirely based then on what you just described, where there's not as many marriages, or is there anything that really is changing that we are being less likely, if we get married, to divorce?
Yeah, so it's both. So if the article had been fully accurate, they would have said the divorce rate is down, but the marriage rate has also plummeted, right? So much fewer people are getting married today. And we do have to ask ourselves the question about why that is so. So we tend to think about marriage increasingly as something that's more like a status symbol. So I've been married for 35 years. When I got married way back in the dark ages, it was that thing where, you know, I got married before I had finished school, before I had kind of done all of the major, you know, kind of markers that mark the transition to adulthood. That's not how it happens today. Today, young people feel like they need to have their career, they need to have a home, they need to be settled. And then it's the last thing that they do. They go out and they find a partner. And so part of this is that couples, instead of jumping into marriage relatively early in life, are waiting longer and longer to do so. And many then, once they're cohabiting with a partner, probably don't feel that urge as an earlier generation might have, that they needed to get married because they've already been living together and it's, you know, it feels less necessary. And it's also then the question about whether, what does marriage represent today? If it is this status symbol, if it is this sense of security that people tend to think that it is, then it might also then only be available to those who have the resources to be able to enter into marriage. And we are, yeah.
No, is it a good thing though? And I mean, I know it's an ethereal question to say, is it a good thing to be married or not? But I mean, before I was talking to you today, I was looking up a number of references to studies that have been done on cohabitation as a precursor to marriage. And most of these studies seem to suggest if you live together before you get married, you have a higher percentage chance of ending up getting a divorce. I don't know if there are more recent studies that say otherwise, but it seems that those who get married right away, as opposed to living together, do better.
So that used to be true. So it depends on what studies you were looking at. But the more recent literature suggests that relationship is fading away. So you can pack it apart in a couple of different ways. So first of all, like if you think about cohabitation as a trial marriage, as a precursor, right? The idea is what you're doing is you're testing out your partner, right? And so if the relationship isn't working out and you dissolve the relationship, like that's no harm, no foul in a sense, right? It's like, okay, so you were not my soulmate. I'm going to go and find the next partner. Like that's the new way in which we do couple relationships today. In the past, right? That option would have been available. It would have been like, no, you don't live, living in sin, you go and you marry your partner, and then you're kind of stuck with that choice. So it's that idea, right, of thinking about why do people choose to go into cohabiting relationships versus marriage? And it means then again that the people who are going directly into marriage today are a very unique group.
It suggests good news or a bad news, depending how you want to look at this. The good news is that if you live together, you get that trial run. There's a less of a chance you'll go through the anguish and the financial ruin potentially of a divorce. The flip side is, though, it almost suggests that we are worse as a society at the whole idea of committing to something and sticking with it.
Yeah, we live in a consumer culture, and that now applies to relationships. Don't forget, we've got all these dating websites where you can go online and find your soulmate. Well, we approach our marriages in the same sense too, right? That we are in it for as long as it fulfills our needs. But if it isn't, we increasingly feel free that we can leave marriage.
That seems very different. Maybe I'm naive. I don't know. Maybe I'm old fashioned. I had parents who were married for 60 something years. So maybe I'm just in a different place, but that seems very different from the way things were 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Yeah. And that's why that comparison of the divorce statistics, if you're looking across time, you'd have to pretend that marriage today is the same as it was back then. And as you're realizing, right, it's fundamentally not. I mean, the very first relationship that most young adults experience today is a cohabiting relationship. 40 years ago, that just didn't happen.
Do you believe that we are the product of our parents? So if we're having all these cohabiting relationships, there's probably, well, I know for a fact, there are tons of kids who are born into one of those. Does that make them more likely to do the exact same thing? Or do we look for things that fly in the face of what our parents did?
Well, we still believe in finding our soulmate. It's just that we don't necessarily think that we have to formalize that relationship in marriage. Right. So the idea is still like, we still go see these movies. There's the Hallmark movies on that are playing
every single day.
Right? Every single day for anyone who, right, wants their little hit of romance.
Yep.
So, the romance hasn't left. We still hope to find, our true love. But it's that we live in a world now that's just fundamentally different. It's no longer about this, tradition and commitment. It's really about being in the relationship for as long as it satisfies your needs.
Again, maybe I'm naive, but the way that's described sounds sad to me.
It is if that's how, I think relationships have the potential to change people though, right? And that's the thing, right? Is when you find your true love and you actually are engaged in that relationship, when the inevitable headwinds come, and they do, right? Trouble can be found anywhere.
Absolutely.
It can make couples stronger just as much as it can break them up. And I don't think you can predict with any accuracy who's going to fare better and who's going to fare worse. But I think it speaks more to, the human condition, that our ability to actually rise above what our initial tendencies might be. I think there is something that's still deeper there.
You've studied this. Do you believe that we are less capable of maintaining deep interpersonal relationships than we once were, that people once were? Because so much of our life is about, it's about you, it's about your happiness, it's about doing what you want, as opposed to nurturing and making sure something you've committed to stays healthy.
Yeah, so we live in a world where we prioritize freedom of choice. And what we could do is look at that in the opposite. So what did life look like in the 1950s when you married, the person who was available to you at the time in your small community, because you couldn't look beyond that, and then found out after a few years that you were locked into an unhappy marriage?
You stuck it out. generally.
Yeah, exactly, right? And so which world is better? Do you want lots of unhappy people in marriages, or do you want people being happier because they're able to make their own choices? And I can't answer that question. Those are two fundamentally different worlds, and it describes really the transition that we've gone through in the past 50 years.
You mentioned right off the top as we began this, you talked about how the divorce rate is down, and it probably is down because we have far fewer marriages right now. But is there any way of knowing if the rate corresponds with the number of marriages? I mean, once upon a time we used to hear the number. I have no idea if it was true, but we used to hear that, oh, every one out of every two marriages breaks down. And as I say, I have no idea if those stats were right, but do we know that regardless of how many marriages there are, the divorce rate is roughly the same?
Yeah, so that one in two is actually an American statistic. So the divorce rate is always been higher in the States than in Canada. We're in the 40% range.
Still high.
Exactly, still high. But of course, yes, the rate over time has been trending downwards, right? So the divorce rate is always the rate per marriages. So the divorce rate itself is coming down. But again, the idea here is that you've got to think about who's getting selected into marriage, who's most likely to get married. Well, those are relationships already that are most likely to be stable because both people have a greater investment in the relationship. And it just reflects again that we have different choices. Young people today, right, are much more likely to say, "Hey, let's live together first and figure things out." And only then, if things are working out really well, do they decide to proceed into marriage. And again, over time, right, it used to be that being in a premarital cohabitation meant that your risk for divorce was higher. That's no longer true today. And it's because there's so many young people who are seeking out cohabitation as their first experience.
We don't, we're short on time right now, but one more thing about this is I'm wondering, we have heard in the last few months that the government has announced that in the next few years, to try and spur population growth, we're going to be having greater immigration, up to 500,000 immigrants coming into the country. There are a lot of cultures where divorce is still not an okay thing. Do we expect that that would change our numbers? That not necessarily what you're talking about the psychology of it, but just the cultural impact might change those numbers over time.
Yeah, so really what you'd be talking about now is the fertility rate, and that has plummeted as well. So it's a whole other set of problems. Not only are people not marrying, but they're also not having children. And for that reason, right, unless we have high levels of immigration, Canada's population is going to decline and
Right.
decline rapidly.
Right. But those people who are coming, maybe not many, some of the countries from which they'll be coming frowns upon divorce. So does that mean that we will see fewer divorces in the country simply for cultural reasons?
Potentially. So, of course, what happens over time is that immigrant populations tend to resemble the Canadian born, right? Over time, they adjust their own practices. And also, we tend to want to recruit people who are have higher education, right? Have more resources. You're right, that would be a group that would be more likely to stay married. I don't know. That's the numbers of that are probably not going to, right? We're a country of 38 million, right? Of 500,000 people every year is probably just going to nudge that up a little bit.
One more thing before I let you go. And th there are, again, some places in the world, there are arranged marriages or something along those lines. Do we know, does anybody know, has anyone done studies? Do we know if those marriages survive at the same rate, at a greater rate, or at a lesser rate than those that are love marriages, for lack of a better term?
Yeah, they survive at exactly the same rate.
Oh, so it's so there's no magic elixir out there to say just line your kids up with someone and they're good to go. That's doesn't exactly work like that.
Yeah, no. In cultures where, and again, marriage means something different in those cultures, and there it's normative, right, to have an arranged marriage. They tend to stay together and have as much happiness in marriage as do married couples who find each other through love.
I said last thing, but one more. Do you ever see the pendulum swinging back? I mean, politically, we see the pendulum swing. In social things, we see the pendulum swing. Could you see a time when suddenly marriage becomes the cool thing to do right away again, or are those days gone?
Because we live in a culture that celebrates people's right to choose, it seems hard to think of a time where that might swing the other way. But, you know, we just lived through a pandemic, and that means anything can happen.
Anything. See, and that's exactly right. I thought the pandemic may be the reason why no one was getting a divorce. They couldn't get out of their house to separate from each other. So, you know, maybe not the reason. Dr. Lisa Strohschein from the University of Alberta, a great conversation. Thanks so much for doing this today.
Hey, thank you.
The Scott Radley Show, weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.